Vancouver in 2019 is regularly ranked as one of the top cities to live in globally. But it wasn't always that way. Go back 95 years to when author John McLaughlin Gray says Vancouver was a dirty, smelly, corrupt hellhole, a place that played host to what is now the oldest cold case in the city's history. In White Angel, McLaughlin Gray takes us inside the seamy underbelly of the city. Not just the skids, but the entire city. He introduces us to a police department that is, or was, let's say, less than professional. High society that was scandalous, adulterous, and outright corrupt. The city across all socioeconomic levels was blatantly racist. Racist to everyone, and to the Chinese in particular. White Angel is the story of the murder of a Scottish nanny in a Shaughnessy mansion. It is a story of lies, orgy, alcohol, drug abuse, and police corruption. It is centered around the murder by gunshot of Janet Stewart and the subsequent ham-handed police investigation and cover-up. As Gray points out, the city is buzzing with rumors. And the story spins out of control as the powerful United Council of Scottish Societies demands an inquiry. The murder victim's fellow nannies have accused the Chinese houseboy of the murder, and the newly established Ku Klux Klan, which took up residency in Shaughnessy, picks up the cause by abducting the poor young man and attempts to beat a confession out of him. The poor houseboy escapes the custody of the KKK, only to be arrested by the police, who promptly charge him with murder. It is a case that is beautifully told by one of Vancouver's most colorful playwrights and authors. Throw in an undertaker who alerts a failed poet-turned-journalist about Janet Stewart's death and the subsequent cover-up, and the story becomes so real your senses come alive. As Gray points out, the killing created a situation analogous to lifting a large, flat rock to expose the creatures hiding. And those creatures represent a wholly inglorious and unglamorous city. As you turn the pages, you can't help but ask yourself, what happened to Vancouver? How did we go from a lawless city with a thriving criminal class to the city of today? We have to admit, it is a dramatic transformation. But to take us all the way back to 1924, we invited John McLaughlin Gray to join us for a conversation that matters about how the cold case of the Scottish nanny epitomizes Vancouver in its 1924 opium-hazed, smoke-choked, and rain-soaked, uglier day.
Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
Welcome to Conversations.
Thank you, Stuart.
Thank you for joining me. I had a great time reading your book.
I bike ride down here. It was just great.
Well, it's perfect weather, isn't it?
Vancouver, man, you do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It makes you a little sweaty.
The book, okay.
But that's okay. The book. This is a great book.
Thank you. I enjoyed reading it.
You have such colorful language. And you really sort of take me inside different rooms and different places around Vancouver. And you paint a picture of Vancouver just shy of 100 years ago. It's not that attractive.
Oh, it was a hellhole.
It really was.
Oh, God, it was more polluted than you can imagine now. The water was more polluted. The air was more polluted. It was full of guys with PTSD. Mm-hmm. It had a bad drug problem, drug smuggling, drug importation. It had a furious real estate fever going on.
Some of those things you could just cut and paste into today.
Yeah, that's why I like it.
You know? Well, what compelled you to write this book, The White Angel? Because it is one of Vancouver's great unsolved murder cases.
Yeah. And that's really attractive because it hasn't been solved, and so that I can solve it. Mm-hmm. I mean, or I can pretend to solve it, or I can suggest a what if. kind of thing. But really, it's a plot like that, you're trying to This kind of plot, it's a little bit like the movie Chinatown, mm-hmm. with Jack Nicholson.
Yes.
That there's a central incident, there's a murder.
Yeah.
That causes a rock to be flipped over. And uh-huh. you get to see all the kind of wriggly things kind of crawling out underneath. Mm-hmm. And that's what I liked about it, the story.
Wriggly things everywhere, in every level of society. It was extraordinary.
Extraordinary, yeah. The police got... Well, at that time... Well, the thing about the police then, you see, was that it was only that year that the War Measures Act came off, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So the police who had been working for the last... Like, since the beginning of the war.
Like 10 years, then.
That's right. Yeah. We're used to just, if you suspected somebody, you just took them in and you beat a confession out of them. And that was that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was no habeas corpus. There was nothing like that.
Right.
And so, and they were also hired by, shall we say, out of a fairly narrow field of well-bodied men who weren't serving. And why weren't they serving? You know, so they weren't the cream of the crop, shall we say. So you've got a wonderful vista of incompetence because, you know, there's a trial thing there. And they ask these questions, and a lot of it is verbatim. I just pulled it from the trial because wow. I couldn't make up anything more ridiculous than that. I mean, they say, you know, a bullet. They said that it was either suicide. She was doing the laundry that morning, and she pointed the gun at her own head and shot herself for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Or it was an accident, i.e., she fired the gun. She was fooling around with the gun. She fired it, ricocheted all over the room, and hit her straight between the eyes. And the policeman was asked about, does that seem reasonable to them? And the reply was, well, it's got to go someplace.
I got to get you to hang on for a second while I take a quick commercial break. I'll be right back. Conversations That Matter is brought to you by Odlum Brown, a client-focused investment firm that starts client relationships with straightforward conversations focused on you, your aspirations, and your investment priorities. Odlum Brown has been a supporter of Conversations That Matter from the day we started this show. Their only condition was that we provide a non-biased conversation with people from all sides of all sorts of issues. And of course, we couldn't produce this show without the support of Oh Boy Productions. If you're looking to produce a show like this one, I suggest you reach out to Oh Boy. They can help you produce it, and they can help you build your audience. And we also need your support. I ask you to please pledge $1 per show by going to conversationsthatmatter.tv/donate, because those dollars add up. Play an important role in helping us produce this show. Now, back to the show. You do a wonderful job of creating these characters with vivid descriptions, from McCurdy, yeah. the reporter, to Sparrow, him. Who's working for the Undertaker, and Gorsman, right? Gorman.
Gorman. Oh,
yeah, Constable Gorman and Constable Hook.
Gorman's his real name. Was Green, and he did end up somehow, when he was kicked off the force, and somehow found the money to buy a hotel.
Oh, somehow found that money.
Isn't that fortunate? I think that's wonderful. And there was also he was a tin nose man, what they call a tin nose man, which was Sparrow, you mm-hmm. know, that in the First World War, they weren't prepared for the kinds of artillery
right.
and stuff. Then you get a shrapnel wound, right? And it's scoped and you get it's blasted and you'll get wounds that are like your face blew up,
mm-hmm.
basically, you
right.
know? And in triage, it's a pretty darn... dodgy business, just trying to keep them alive. So there are men, and I've seen pictures of them with half their faces are made of this very, very thin metal.
Yeah. Well, you go into great detail depicting how the artist
literally
draws his face back onto this piece of tin.
Yeah, and they had tremendous skill. It was in France.
Yeah.
It was an atelier in France, and they would use these brushes with about three bristles on them, and they would get a face, and they claimed that some guy would have half his face missing, and you couldn't tell until he was like 3 feet from you. Even the eyes seemed to change. It was quite remarkable. I mean, it's just a combination of horror, but also just this sort of amazing human ability to kind of. And some of the letters I read, I mean, of the guys who said, you know, thanked them because he could go home and he could go outside and he could be with his wife and his kids and he didn't cause people to scream to look at him.
Well, in the case of Sparrow, you had him romantically linked to somebody who didn't mind kissing him.
No, more. Not at all. No, yeah. It was only the upper part of the face, mind you. It was his eye was blown out. But the other thing was that I always been interested in brain damage in the sense that is brain damage entirely damaged? Mm-hmm. Like, does it, for example, damage things but enhance others?
Well, according to Dr. Norman Doidge, who wrote The Brain That Changes Itself, that's exactly what happens, is the brain compensates.
Yes.
And so long as you continue to use your brain and activate other regions, the brain will make compensation.
Well, it made Sparrow a bit... These are real people to me now. I mean, all of them.
They're real people to me now.
Yeah. It made Sparrow kind of psychic, and slightly. He was slightly clairvoyant.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, and I have a lot of clairvoyance in my novels. They show up every so often. And the thing about clairvoyance, I do believe there is such a thing, but it can't be controlled, right? So you'd have to be a psychic yourself to know when the clairvoyant was right and when he wasn't, right? And anyone who claims to do it consistently is a fake, you know? You can't.
So
yeah,
the book is very closely chronicles the actual case of Janet Smith, who was a Scottish nanny working in the Shaughnessy area.
And she was working, and she had worked with them in Europe and in England, and she came here with the family.
Right.
And the guy had a sort of odd background, kind of slightly checkered background, dealt in antiques.
Right.
And antiques were used for various purposes.
You could move an awful lot of things
within his partner. I don't make up facts. What I make up is the lines between the facts.
Mm-hmm.
That's, which is, I think, what historians do, frankly. But they just have more footnote.
I bring up the fact that this relates to the real case of Janet Smith.
Yeah.
But
oh, sure.
In your book, you name her Janet Stewart.
Yeah.
Why? Why separate from her actual name and give her a fictitious name?
It's because a lot of them started out as real people. Mm-hmm. Most of them did. The thing about Janet Smith was she's got relatives in Scotland and descendants in Scotland. And I really suspect from her diaries and stuff that she wasn't quite the angel that she was purported to be, right?
Well, that kind of becomes clear near the end of the book.
But yes. I don't really want to kind of cloud that so that I squeal out of it in the beginning to say, yeah, they're based on people. But then I kind of take off. It's like McCurdy started off as Earl Burney, the poet.
Oh, okay.
Because Earl Burney was a young reporter working for the Marpole paper. These were all separate communities.
Yeah.
And he was a poet, but then I decided that he was a failed poet.
Mm-hmm.
And Burney wasn't a failed poet, so then away we veer off.
Yeah, for the convenience of story, it's better to have another name.
Well, he wanted to be, yes, because he wanted... The character wanted to be a failed poet. I didn't want to have to.
Why was he speaking to you in the night, telling you what he wanted to be?
I didn't want to have to write good poetry for one thing.
Because that's outside of your normal area of expertise.
No, I can't write good poetry.
No, but you do use colorful language.
I think the disturbing part about this, and especially if we reflect back on our history and our relationship with Chinese Canadians, is that they were brutalized. And here you have this houseboy who happens to find her. And then it's clear, even from anything that you read about the actual case, there's no way that he could have been the perpetrator, and yet he becomes ensnared in this.
Well, the mystery is why it took them so long to accuse him.
Right.
What were they protecting? What was going on? What did he know?
Mm-hmm.
Because they only at the last, out of the, as a last resort, did they actually charge him. And of course, it was so flimsy, he went straight out of, it was just...
But they only charged him after he had been abducted and brutalized for weeks.
This was the height of the anti-Asian the Asian Exclusion League.
Well, the Exclusion Act had just come in, hadn't it?
Yes,
around that time.
And Mary Ellen Smith, the first MLA, had just sponsored a bill that had that white women and Oriental men, they call them Oriental, couldn't work under the same roof. Right, and they had, and the KKK had moved in. They had just come in, and the KKK was of the 20s. What was a very different. I'm working on it now in another novel on the KKK because they're a very different item than what you think of post Reconstruction in the American Civil War, because the KKK was based on a movie, was based on Birth of a Nation, right? And it was created by a publicity company, the Southern Publicity Association. And they took all the trappings of the KKK, used its brand that came out of the movie, right? And created really what was kind of an Amway situation, right? Because it was funded by its members, okay? So they went in, and what they did was they would send out canvassers to find out who people hated. And it was, depending on where it was Catholics, it was Jews, it was Blacks, Asians, right?
Yeah.
In Saskatchewan, which was a big center for the KKK, it was Ukrainians.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So it was, they were basically the hate group for hire or du jour, and they would assemble a group, right? And they would grow until they couldn't grow anymore, and then they would just move on, you know? It's a fascinating business.
So what's interesting, though, about this is, of course, there is the Scottish Societies and the Reverend McDermott who gets involved and really incites this.
He's based on a real guy. He had his own little magazine, and he was he's this kind of Trumpian figure, you know? He has he really tries to fan the flames of anything that's going on against, especially Catholics and Asians, and you know, he was a bad one. And the Scottish Societies, well, that was Eric Nickel, the humorist, used to talk about them muttering into their porridge. I mean, they were always, because the place was so heavily Scottish, you know. And they were a very conservative, kind of tight-knit group, and they were suspicious.
Well, and it would seem that they were striving to preserve Janet's reputation.
Absolutely. A Scottish girl. I think she was an angel, and that was how there was the Scottish Societies that branded her an angel.
How much fun did you have writing this book?
I did it to have fun.
Yeah.
You know, Stuart Frank, I didn't expect to get it published. You know, I mean, I've had books published by the big publishers, but I was a bit of a commercial disappointment. I got a huge advance, and the downside to a huge advance is if you don't sell, it's all your fault. Okay? If you don't sell commensurate with your huge advance. So I got three novels out of them. One, two, three, four. And then they didn't even want to read what I was doing. I mean, now the publishing business in the big one, since it's been pulled, it's been taken over.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they work on years. Not, yeah. They don't work long term. So it's your bottom line of the year. It used to be that they would invest not in a book, but in an author, right? Mm-hmm. And they would figure, okay, he didn't sell this one, but he will sell and it will backsell his previous stuff, right? They don't do that anymore, right?
Oh, okay.
And so, but Harper doesn't care. Harper just wants to do the right. They are the old-fashioned book seller, Howard White. And Howard, mm-hmm. When he's interested in a book, he wants to publish it, you
yeah.
know? And so you're not dealing with the same thing. And I just sent it to him because I'd been writing it for fun, and I sent it to Howard, and I said, well, just see what you think. And he said, well, I like it. What do we do now? And so I...
there's one thing that I have to touch on here. Of course,
yes.
your name is John McLaughlin Gray.
Yeah, yeah.
And you go, okay, why the McLaughlin? And I know it's because of the confusion around John Gray, who wrote...
There were several John Grays I had to deal with, because I when I started writing books, there was John Gray with a mail order PhD who wrote Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus.
Yes.
And I would find myself going sometimes in places like, I don't have anything against Chilliwack, but this happened in Chilliwack.
Yeah.
Where I went for a reading and there were people who came who did not look like my readers, or shall we say.
Yeah.
And what they came for was reactionary sexual advice, which is I really didn't. Oh, that's the, and then I got a job.
Well, hang on, before you go on to that,
yeah.
I picked up on one little reference you made to that in the newsroom when he goes, you know, what do you think I am, from Venus or something? I thought that was funny.
That was a little private sort of thing. Yeah,
I saw it and enjoyed it.
There are a few of those, you know.
Yeah.
I got a column with the Globe and Mail, and there was an eminence Greece named John Gray who had been doing foreign policy and foreign columns for years and years and years. And so,
yeah.
And that year was the year my mother died, and her name was McLaughlin.
Uh-huh.
And so I went Spanish.
Yeah. You know? Added in her name.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I hope you keep writing, because I had so much fun. There were a few times when I had to stop and pick up the dictionary because you've got a couple of words that are beyond me. And I enjoy that. And so, you know, your writing helps push me into areas that I don't think about.
That says something for you.
Yeah.
Because you were curious.
Yeah.
Because when I do that, you could have gotten it out of context.
Yes.
You could have gotten it, inferred it in context.
Right.
But you said, no, I want to know what that word means. That's... Well, my kind of guy. Yeah.
Well, you're my kind of writer. I really enjoyed this book, and I hope that you go on to write more, and hopefully more about Vancouver, because
if you're doing
things that allow us to see our past and the progression to where we are now,
yeah.
I think that you're going to do a great service as a storyteller and as a historian.
Thank you so much, Stuart.
Thank you for coming
Good
in
to
and
talk
doing
to
this.
You.
And likewise.